May it please the court, Jacqueline Delgado on behalf of Mr. Jimmy Pierre. One of the, what we're going to concentrate most on during oral arguments is going to be the CIMT charge. The statute here where the petitioner was convicted is just a glorified simple battery statute. The statute describes four instances in the way a child can be battered upon by doing that instance in five different ways. One of the issues is the statute at this point is divisive how it is written in the according to the wording of this statute. The most important thing is that the statute has an attempt in the word of attempt in the statute, which automatically pulls it out of the CIMT as it's written in the statute. Most criminal statutes that have an attempted element, it would be a completely different section of the same statute. But here, the word attempt is written directly into the wording of the allegations that the prosecution or the conviction held.
I understood that under Florida law, an attempt requires an act. It requires some manifestation. So how does that fit into your argument?
Well, the attempt statute here is there. He doesn't even have to have an act according to that statute. It just needs to be attempted. So if you are planning on doing something, that is not sufficient according to the...
You couldn't be accused of violating the statute through attempt without some act.
Well, I would argue that you can't be convicted of it, even though it's in the statute. That leaves it very vague and ambiguous as to whether Mr. Pierre ever acted in any way to commit a battery on a child. Generally...
Counsel, doesn't Thomas v. State say that you have to have a specific intent to commit the crime and an overt act?
Yes, and here there is no over, according to this, the way the statute is written with the word attempt, there is no overt act if you just attempt to do something.
But in that case, they were construing the statute, weren't they?
Yes, they were, but when we construe the statute here, the petitioner was convicted of not attempting to do something, a separate act or a separate statute. In this case, the word attempt is actually in the plain meaning of the statute, which takes it outside of that overaction needed. Even though it is unknowingly cause or attempt to cause, but there is no overt action when you attempt to cause something. And further, the contact that is necessary for this statute is not a contact that uses deadly weapon or serious injury, which traditionally the courts have found to be a CIMT.
Give me an example of attempt to cause where there wouldn't be conduct or an action.
Well,
I don't know how you attempt to cause if you don't do something.
Exactly, but
I could ask you to go do this act.
But if I never do it, then I never attempted it, which is kind of what the argument is, that an attempt to do something shouldn't be held as a CIMT when there is never anything done. Including the fact that the statute doesn't even have...
When you mean by never having anything done, you mean because the child never came in contact with...
Anything.
The child, you just attempted to have the child come in contact with it.
Correct. And
the attempt was unsuccessful.
Correct. Or exactly. That could be one example. Whether the attempt was is unsuccessful, then that's something else. But if he never even the attempt was not successful, is fine. But the point is that nothing, according to this statute, him just attempting is a battery, which is not the way that battery has traditionally been defined, which is touching against one's will. And here, there doesn't even have to be that contact. And that contact can be so slight, or there is never that contact. And the CIMT traditionally cause, especially when it's with a child, which we understand is somebody that society tends to protect, usually there is the element of serious injury or deadly weapon. And this is not, none of those two elements are classified or outlined in this statute.
About his asylum attempt, he entered the United States as an asylee initially, but he never sought asylum? He never applied for it?
Correct. So the underlining record shows that the attorney never actually filed asylum as a defense to removability. So therefore, he never actually applied for it again. But he adjusted as an asylee through his father. So that goes to the arguments that were made as to the motion to continue arguments, where it is the opinion of
okay, so he had asylee status?
He did, and he adjusted. He entered as an asylee, and he adjusted to a legal permanent resident as an asylee.
Okay. But that doesn't stop him from being removable, right?
Well,
unless he has the 7 years and no moral turpitude, right?
Well, that's correct. But at some point, the argument was made that if the motion to pretermit by the government would have been filed timely, then respondent would have had sufficient time to, at that point, file an asylum application if he is taken outside, if he is no longer a green card holder. So he suffered prejudice in that attempt, in that instance, when the government filed on April 30th a motion to pretermit, and the hearing was on May 4th. At that point, the judge had given everybody a call-up date, and underlying counsel did file a 42A application, which was pretermitted. But at some point, he probably should have filed the asylum, and that's the third argument in our brief, that he should have, respondents should have been given the opportunity because of the prejudice against him that suffered by the late filing on DHS's accord.
So tell me what would happen. He applies for asylum.
Correct.
And then how does that affect the proceeding that he's in?
So he could have applied for asylum, withholding, or CAT. So at that point, he would have been able to present evidence as to an asylum application and had a complete hearing on the asylum application that he was a derivative from on behalf of his father.
Okay, so the derivative asylum puts him in a different position than getting asylum on his own?
Well, no, it just shows that he could possibly have a claim for asylum on his own. That's all it shows. It doesn't put him in a different position. It just shows that he can and he should have had they been aware of the DHS memo to pretermit that was filed untimely, then he would have filed for an asylum, withholding, or CAT.
Couldn't he have done that in the last couple of years?
Yeah, but DHS could have also filed their motion to pretermit in the last couple of years, which is where he was never even put on notice that this statute, that they were going to pursue this as a CIMT, because he's not charged with the CIMT in the NTA. The only thing that he's charged with is the child abuse claim.
All right. What is an I-589?
The I-589 is the asylum application.
Okay. I just want to make sure.
Yeah. So
suppose they hadn't filed the motion to preterm it. What would the district judge or the IJ have done?
He would have. It depends on the judge. The judge is Judge Mateo, so he could have had a full-blown hearing, and at that point made a decision whether it was a CIMT or not. But the CIMT issue was never even brought up until the motion to preterm it, because it was only the government withdrew the two CIMT charges.
Okay, but the grounds for asylum, if he were to file one, had existed at all times anyway. I understand he said, well, I didn't know about this, so I didn't want to file it. It was only a backup idea. But if you're seeking asylum, the basis for the asylum existed from the beginning of the removal proceedings.
That's correct. It did.
Okay, so but when they filed the NTA, they started the whole thing. He had grounds for asylum.
Correct.
Then, okay, and he never filed it.
But the
any event, in any time, and even after the ruling here, he never filed one.
That's correct. But the opportunity was, while it was presented to him throughout, the attorney made it clear that the 428 was the strongest case, and on the record at page 121.
We understand that, but alternative claims are made all the time.
Right.
And particularly here, there was no new development of facts. If the asylum claim was there, it was there before. What would his asylum claim have been?
It would have probably based on family, particular social group of the father.
In Haiti?
In Haiti, correct. Right. And he would have fear of returning, but he was already a green card holder.
Because of what? The social group of the father was what, and what's going to happen?
Well, the particular social group of the father, I've never actually seen the father's asylum application,
okay.
But it would probably be as a family member of the father.
So the asylum claim would have been derivative?
It would have been a particular social group. It wouldn't have been derivative, because
okay.
It would be his own asylum claiming that because he was the family of, but at this point we're speculating because he never filed it, but that would have been.
Has he ever proffered what the asylum claim is going to be at any time here?
Not on the record, no.
Right.
But it was indicated that the father did gain asylum in Haiti, and that's how he was brought to the United States.
The father obtained asylum in the United States.
Based on the situation in Haiti, whatever that would have been.
Okay.
I see my time is up, so I'll yield my 5
Thank
minutes.
You.
Thank you.
You'll keep your rebuttal of 5.
Yes.
Ms. Corliss.
Good morning. Lindsay Corliss for the respondent. We ask that the court deny the petition for review and uphold the board's decision below. It's undisputed in this case that petitioner was convicted of violating Florida Statute 784.085, which prescribes knowingly throwing, expelling, projecting, or tossing blood, urine, feces, or seminal fluid at a child. There are 3 disputed issues in this case.
Or attempting to cause.
It's the attempt is actually attempting to cause the child to come in contact, but the overt act is by throwing, projecting, expelling, tossing. So the defendant must actually direct these bodily fluids at the child, and they must do so with at least the intent of having the child come into contact with those substances. But the attempt part is if he were to throw feces and miss the child, then that would be an attempt that would fall under this statute. But the overt act of the actual throwing, projecting, directing.
Can I ask about the hearing?
Yes.
What was the notice to Mr. Pierre for the hearing? What did it tell him was going to happen at the hearing? Anything specific?
The original notice to appear or to... Well, in the original notice to appear...
Put it all together. What information did he have from whatever notices he was given before the hearing?
Okay, so he originally, in July of 2012, was given a notice to appear, and he was informed of the charges against him.
And what did they say?
At that time, it was two crimes involving moral turpitude. That was a charge that was ultimately withdrawn, and also that he was removable as an alien convicted of a crime of child abuse, neglect, or abandonment.
Okay, so they charged him. The notice said moral turpitude and the child neglect charge.
Yes. Petitioner thereafter obtained counsel, and he subsequently was given, there were multiple continuances of this case while he was represented by counsel on August 7th, 2012, August 14th, 2012, September 13th, 2012, and then finally on April 25th, 2013, that was probably the most relevant to our discussion here. On that date, his attorney stated that they were planning on filing cancellation of removal and likely an asylum application. The immigration judge asked how much time would be necessary for them to compose those applications and file them. And petitioner's attorney at that time said that he would need about a month. The immigration judge informed petitioner that he didn't have a hearing date that close in time, so he actually set it out a year and stated, you have a year on your case. And again, he confirmed with the petitioner's counsel, he stated, all applications, including an asylum application, would be due on the same date. Petitioner's counsel at that point agreed, and so then when they reconvened a year later, petitioner had only filed his cancellation of removal application, had not filed an asylum application. I also think it's important to mention that petitioner didn't walk into court and say, I have this evidence that I need to file in order to support my application. He actually waited until the immigration judge had already pretermitted his cancellation of removal application, ordered him removed, and then he said, I didn't think I needed to file a backup application, and then he asked for a continuance in order to do so. The immigration judge is not required to go through in applicants' separate applications in separate hearings. Part of the regulations are that the immigration judge is allowed to set deadlines, and generally a petitioner is entitled to one merits hearing on all of those applications.
Did the immigration judge's order at that time preclude him from taking any other actions on asylum? I mean, does the order itself preclude that?
Well, no, not specifically. He was certainly, at least for the cancellation of removal application, he could have filed a motion to reconsider if there were a different legal argument that he wanted to present regarding the crime involving moral turpitude argument.
Yeah, right, he also then and there filed for asylum, or does the immigration judge's order cut that off?
If he would have to establish a reason. For instance, he could have filed a motion to reopen alleging ineffective assistance of counsel, for instance, stating that the reason why his application is being filed late and he needs his proceedings opened is because he received ineffective assistance. So he certainly could have done that at that point through the motion to reopen. I don't know what the circumstances of his case were. He could have potentially, and I'm just speculating, filed a motion to reopen alleging changed country conditions in Haiti that now give him an opportunity to apply for asylum.
Does this past status as an asylee give him any special status?
It doesn't, for a couple of reasons. So petitioner at this point, it would only be eligible for withholding of removal or cat protection based on a disqualifying conviction, the crime involving moral turpitude and the crime of child abuse, neglect, or abandonment. Additionally, petitioner, we can't say that he is prima facie eligible. He came in as a derivative, which means that he never established that he faced a personal risk. So if he had established previously that he himself was going to actually face persecution, then perhaps his case might have been a little stronger. But here, all we know is that his father established that he had a well-founded fear, and so he was able to bring his minor children in as derivatives. So we don't know if petitioner himself would have had you know, any sort of reason to fear a personal risk.
Back to overt act and this particular statute, do you have any Florida cases you cite with regard to construing this statute?
We don't. That's actually a statute that is not
used that much.
It's not.
We couldn't find anything on the statute, is there?
That was pretty much the only cases that we were able to find were cases where petitioner was charged for multiple crimes, including like lewdness, lascivious conduct on a young person, and then that charge wasn't discussed. It wasn't analyzed to a point where you can discuss an attempt. The other thing that I wanted to mention is that even if all this person was doing was attempting, it still constitutes both maltreatment of a child and reprehensible conduct. If you can compare this case to, say, Gelen, G-E-L-E-N, versus U.S. Attorney General, that is a case that deals with elder abuse or abuse of the disabled. And this court has found that is a crime involving moral turpitude. The specific statute that case was analyzing criminalized the knowing active encouragement of another person to commit an act that either results in injury or could reasonably result in injury to an elderly person or a disabled person without causing serious bodily injury. And the way that the court had defined the injury that could possibly be called caused, it includes psychological injury. And this court has found that elder abuse statute was a categorical crime involving moral turpitude because you have this act, which is morally reprehensible, and it's being perpetrated upon a group of people that is particularly vulnerable in society, that being the elderly or disabled adults. If you compare that to this case, we have an even stronger act because it's the defendant himself throwing, expelling, tossing these substances at a child rather than just encouraging another person to act.
What is your best case under Florida law that attempt always requires an overt act? I understand she's
right.
Saying this statute has the attempt within the terms of the statute as opposed to a separate statute that says attempt to do any particular act is also a crime.
Right.
I got her point on that, but let's look within this statute, just attempt law generally under Florida.
Right. Attempt generally, I know we did cite this in our brief, and it is just,
I think she tries to,
me the name of the case.
She construes the statute in a way that it doesn't have.
Right.
Florida
has decided that any attempt does require an overt act.
Yeah, the IJ cites one. He cites Carlton v. State.
That is the one that we have.
Okay, that's a DCA 2012 case. But I just wondered if you had anything else off the top of your head.
No, that was the case that we had relied upon.
Okay.
Okay. If there's no more questions on this topic, perhaps I'll back up a little bit and just make sure that I address the three main issues here. The first being that petitioner's conviction does constitute a categorical crime of child abuse, neglect, or abandonment. Now, this court has not, in a published decision, officially deferred to the board's definition of that term, but this court has afforded Chevron deference to the board's interpretation of the term in an unpublished case, Martinez. And it should continue to do so in this case because the board's definition is reasonable. Now, in matter of Velazquez-Herrera, the board broadly defined the term as any offense involving the intentional, with knowledge, recklessness, or criminal negligence, act or omission that constitutes maltreatment of a child or that impairs a child's physical or mental well-being, including sexual exploitation or sexual abuse. And in finding that definition, the board synthesized many different criminal statutes available at the time, including seven different federal statutes that defined the term child abuse, and synthesized that with what the general understanding of the term was at the time that Congress enacted the INA. And so that's how they determined this broad definition. And all of the the board further refined that definition in matter of Sorum to state that child abuse also includes convictions that don't require actual injury to a child, so long as there's sufficient proof that in, say, an endangerment statute that the harm was likely to arise from the defendant's actions. Now here we have a case where the statute of conviction matches those elements. First, it has adequate mens rea. The statute requires that the defendant act knowingly. Second, the statute requires an act that does constitute maltreatment of a child. Whether you throw, you know, these fluid, you know, bodily fluids at a child and miss or hit him. Either way, this is going to cause a mental injury to a child who instinctively will know that an adult throwing feces at him is doing something that is contrary to the accepted morals in our society. And finally, it involves the child victim. The statute requires that the victim always be under age 18 and that the defendant always be over 18. Moving quickly to the crime involving moral turpitude holding. Petitioner's statute of conviction does constitute a categorical crime involving moral turpitude. Crimes involving moral turpitude are crimes that involve both reprehensible conduct and some degree of scienter. Now here, the scienter is knowing, so that qualification has been met. And second, as I stated, all of the conduct that is possible on your here, whether it's an attempt to cause the child to actually come into contact with these substances that this person directed at them, or whether they actually did make contact, it's going to be vile, base, and depraved conduct. Now, while there's been a comparison to assault and battery statutes, we're ignoring the very clear aggravating factors that bring this above an assault or battery statute. The first and most important being that the victim is always going to be a child. Now, Congress has specifically stated that children are more deserving of the protection, and an assault on a child is more likely to be a crime involving moral turpitude. Second, in a simple battery statute, you have an unwanted touching. There's a difference between a touch with a hand and having a bodily fluid essentially weaponized and thrown or projected or spelled at you. This court has found that in Young versus U.S. Attorney General that this exact statute involves violent force enough to trigger a sentence enhancement. So we do have some sort of force behind that touch. It's not just an unwanted touch. And I do see that my time is running out. So I will just conclude by asking that this court deny the petition for review.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Delgado?
Yes.
Start with the statute. She says the overt act is the attempt to cause, and what the person is by tossing, projecting, the overt act. That statute requires that you toss, project, or whatever it says, and therein, by that act, attempt to cause harm. no, attempt to cause contact.
Correct.
Why is that not a legitimate reading of the statute?
Well, it's not because, again, we're the attempt to cause a child to come into contact. There doesn't even need to be contact.
And I agree with that.
Okay.
All right, but with you. Mm-hmm. But it's attempt to cause the child to come in contact with these fluids by so-and-so. So it seems like the defendant has to do the by tossing so-and-so, attempting, he could either cause contact or attempt to cause contact. Are you following what I'm saying? That's how she reads the statute, that you have to have a toss.
But that toss is at the end of the statute, so I don't... But
so attempt to cause them by, you could say by shooting a gun. But here it says attempt to cause somebody to come in contact with these things by, it could say by.
Yeah, I mean, also we can use the word tossing, which is not a violent word, and it shouldn't be used to enhance this statute, because we all the time we say, let's go out and toss the ball, and we're not going to hit ourselves with the ball. We're tossing the ball, which is something that is nonviolent.
Counsel, focus on the attempt. What I hear the government saying is that the throwing, tossing, projecting, or expelling is the overt act, and that the attempt is you have to have thrown, tossed, projected, or expelled in order to be convicted, just from the face of the statute. That's what I heard the argument is. Can you respond to that?
And my response is that when the statute, the plain reading of the statute has attempt to cause a child to come into contact. It doesn't have the, I agree, the action that the respondent would need to take is to throw, toss, or project. But that's not what the word attempt is qualifying. That's the argument that we're making, that the only attempt is controlling actually contact. And the contact is not described as contact that is violent or causes injury. While we agree with opposing counsel that traditionally the statutes have held, courts have held that a person such as children or domestic partners can have a heightened standard, but the statute does not define anything such as a deadly weapon or any injury. Just as counsel,
argument.
I'm
Are
sorry.
You arguing that you have to attempt to throw, not that you actually have to throw.
I'm arguing that the statute doesn't need to be contact. And once the statute requires that no contact needs to happen, then you don't have an injury that could cause harm, you don't have an injury, and you don't have an action that could be an attempt that could eventually lead to injury, also as in counsel stated in Jelen. Once you don't have that contact, there is nothing, there is no violation of that, there's no CIMT, because there is no qualification of that contact. And traditionally, while children are to be protected, the statutes always call for a deadly weapon or serious injury on the child. All the cases cited in the brief by counsel differentiate this statute. Garcia was a sexual abuse case. Sosa was a case that required permanent disability, permanent disfigurement, or
I don't think any of those cases cite this statute.
They don't, but
they just analyze another statute.
Right, correct, and that's why these other cases, some of them were found to be CIMTs because of that qualification of the contact. Here, we just have contact or an attempted contact, and that, I believe, is the difference, and we can use that to differentiate and show that there is not a CIMT.
Is what you're saying is you could throw, say, urine at a child, but as long as it doesn't have contact, and you would be guilty of the offense. You missed.
Right.
You missed that because it's an attempt situation. That's different than actually if you actually make contact.
I believe that that is what makes the statute divisible.
Okay. I don't think the statute is divisible. I think the statute is not divisible, so you have to look at the least of the offenses, which is attempt.
Okay, so if
the statute is not divisible, I mean, I'm just speaking for myself. IJ said it's not divisible. I think that's correct. So you have to look at the attempt as the least of the offenses.
Correct. And then if you look
even though that's not what happened here, there was actual contact with the fluid, but we don't look at the facts of the crime.
Right. I agree with
I mean, it
with
was sexual
court.
Intercourse. We all know that. We got, I mean, that's what it was. So there was contact on the child.
I agree, but that's not that we're.
So we looked at the statute to see what the least criminal conduct under which you could be convicted.
And that attempt is the main problem.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The next case of the morning, LeJuice.